Les séminaires du Collège de France.
On va passer au séminaire. Je suis très content d'accueillir Marco Cosentino Largo Marcino, qui m'a rappelé tout à l'heure qu'il avait fait un postdoc avec nous à Paris en 2004, ce qui ne nous rajeunit pas beaucoup. Il est maintenant professeur à l'Université de Milan et on s'est un peu retrouvé récemment parce qu'on travaillait avec les mêmes expérimentateurs qui travaillaient sur ces problèmes de volume cellulaire. Donc il a un peu... changer son titre. Où est-ce qu'il est ton titre?
Il n'est pas là. Hein.
Tu m'as dit voilà. Qu'il avait changé. Voilà. Il a un peu changé le titre de son séminaire. Il veut comprendre la croissance cellulaire et c'est de ça qu'il va nous parler, notamment par des modèles guidés par les données. Merci Marco.
Merci. So I will switch to English because my French is really not good enough. First of all, I want to thank Jean-François for this invitation. It's very nice to be here, and I really like the lecture. And I did change my topic. So originally, I wanted to talk about cell cycle control. The way I see this course is some kind of an encounter between models of cell cycle progression or biosynthesis, and we saw this morning, and PLM, biophysical models of osmosis, and all together. And originally I wanted to talk about this, but I will talk about this instead. Which is very related to what we just saw in Jean-François' talk. And I will deliberately not talk about the intersection with these biophysical aspects, but for most of the talk I will assume that we have a cell with constant density, basically. And what I wanted to do is give a very broad introduction to this literature. And we're going to see basically the same equations and the same kind of data that we just saw, just from a different point of view. And then in the second part of the talk, I wanted to talk about a little bit more about some work we did in this area with two examples. One is, as you will see, really, really related to this kinetic model that Jean-François just presented. And the other one is about how you connect sensing of nutrients with allocation of ribosomes. So you have to know, the flux of amino acids, for example, that we just saw, and then decide how much ribosomes you want to allocate to make ribosomes, which will make your ribosomal sector, which will define your growth rate. And we tried to build a coherent model of that. So this is just a group. It's a theory group. Everybody in the group has expertise of statistical physics. We do a lot of data-driven work, and a lot of the time we try to build the model from data. Although it's not always a good idea, sometimes it's better to take a step back and try to start from first principles, which is what I will try to do here. I will show you data, I will show you the modeling frameworks, just as the same approach that Jean-François did. So this was a kind of a very broad and philosophical introduction, because if you talk about these three areas, it's like undebatable that you're talking about physics when you are in this area. But when you are in the theory of cell cycle progression or biosynthesis, in which sense are you talking about physics? So, okay, I will not do this interactively, but I will just show you that I think physics is two things. One thing is a corpus, a body of literature, a body of knowledge. And in this example, this body of knowledge is embodied by a t-shirt, where you have, I think, I don't know, 200 years, you have electromagnetism here, you have Dirac's equation, and you have an interaction with some scalar field. So this is like at least 150 years of physics. But it's also, and I think it's first and foremost, an approach. So it's how you approach a system when you try to build a model with very few parameters, when you try to do dimensional analysis. And this is what we are going to do here. So we're not really going to do, let's say, physics in the strict sense, but we're going to do models of biosynthesis as a physicist would do it. So what is a law? Because we're going to see something that is called growth laws. It's something that's it's really inside the framework that Jean, something went wrong with my, yeah. Okay. Because, so it's really related to the framework that Jean-François presented, but it wasn't like, he didn't touch this topic, which is, I think, how the framework got famous about these growth laws. And so a law, I think there's a, there can be a debate about what is a law. And there can there is also like a debate on whether biology has laws. So here's like a sort of general definition of law that is kind of, I don't know, out there to debate, to discuss, but at least it should occur without our intervention, and it should explain some of the experiments we do, and it has to be falsifiable. Okay, and then in physics we like stuff like this. We like this one. We like it so much that we like it ends up on our tombstones. And but in biology this is not really the case. It's not. I mean, I think it's arguable that in biology there are laws, and biologists think a lot in terms of let's say statements that fit all three definitions above, but they're not expressed by a mathematical formula. But we like to express our laws by mathematical formulas, and I will show you and argue that even in biology, the biology of growth, there are these laws, we just saw some, and some of these, and I will show you basically a general framework that tries to describe them. So, and the other, let's say, big topic is that we need to introduce is whether this growth physiology is universal. And I think Jean-François assumed this, which is, I like it a lot, but usually if you have a biologist in the audience, it's not so automatic, because biology, if you know it, or if you have been in touch with a biologist, is really about a lot of details. For example, when I was presenting previously, I presented this work, this literature, to an audience of biologists. I got a lot of objections. Like, for example, Jean-François had a law for like a mathematical equation for the translation of messengers. Okay, and then they're going to tell you, okay, but which organism are you thinking about? If it's, this is bacteria, then the messengers are in the cytoplasm. If not, if it's like yeast, then everybody knows that the nuclear pores are the limiting factor for the export of messenger RNA. So your biosynthesis rate is going to be a function of the number of nuclear pores. So there's a lot of these details that make these laws maybe not always applicable, and we always have to be very, very cautious. But at the same time, I think Jean-François is really, really right that there are general principles. Because the architecture is the same, because there are ribosomes everywhere, and I will try to walk you through three or four of these principles that basically are from the literature. I didn't invent anything. It's the same literature that Jean-François is following. I guess one name that needs to be mentioned is the name of Terence Hua, if you haven't seen his work. He's a statistical physicist. He's the one that around 2008-2010 put together this framework, putting together also data from older literature where these laws started emerging. But he was, I think, the first one to put it together in a coherent way. So what are the three or four general principles that I think are important for this kind of theories of biosynthesis? One for sure is autocatalysis, so production, something that is producing itself. And this something that is producing itself is the reason why you have exponential growth or exponential biosynthesis. Typically, what is producing itself, it's not the only thing that's producing itself. You have different autocatalytic cycles, but the typical thing that's producing itself is the ribosome. So ribosomes are making ribosomes, and ribosomes make a protein mass, which is, as Jean-Francois said probably multiple times, let's say it's a proxy, we consider it a proxy of the protein, of the total cellular mass. So I can write simple mean field-like equations that we just saw for total protein. Total protein is proportional to ribosomes times an effective translation rate, let's call it. And to ribosomes are made by the ribosomes, the fraction of ribosomes that are making ribosomes. So there's a difference between ribosomal fraction in your proteome, so the fraction of your proteome that is ribosomes, and ribosomal allocation, so the fraction of ribosomes in your proteome, chi r in this equation, that are making ribosomes. And Jean-Francois said, okay, these are the same at steady state, and we're going to see it in a second. So I don't know how to do this. Ah, yes. Okay, you know, I just said this. Because you have autocatalysis, you have exponential growth, which is, in, especially in the bacterial literature, is called balanced growth because it's a steady state for allocation and proteome fractions. So everything is producing itself exponentially, but these chi r's and fr's that we saw and these fractions of let's say biosynthetic ribosomes, for example, that are producing everything are constant in these exponentially growing steady states. So the second thing that we also saw that is a general principle that we should have in this framework, and it's general in every cell that does biosynthesis, has a flux of nutrients which through a complex network comprising catabolism and also metabolism becomes amino acids, gives me a flux of amino acids, which is used to make proteins. So most of my, let's assume that this is a proxy of my biomass. And there's also turnover, so basically this can go back here. But degradation times, especially for microbes, and today we're going to think mostly about yeast, which is a microbe, and E. coli, which is a microbe, it's a bacterium, that are fast growing. If you give them enough nutrients, they grow fast enough that these degradation terms are small. So in this framework, I'm going to neglect it for the moment. And sometimes it's probably going to pop up, but let's assume for today that we are growing fast enough that we can neglect degradation and recycling. It's a very interesting topic, then, and which becomes relevant, especially if you grow slow. So if I neglect this flux, then I only have two fluxes. And then I'm going to assume that these are given by rates times a number of effective enzymes. So this flux is going to be given by a rate per enzyme times the number of enzymes, and this flux is going to be given by a rate per ribosomes times the number of ribosomes. and I sort of have to balance them to get a steady state. We didn't see it. It's a bit more tricky if you keep into account volume dilution, but let's assume that this is not relevant, I think. The relevant thing is that you have to take account for mass conservation, and this is a general principle. And this we already touched. So you have allocation of resources, which is going to get reflected by the cellular composition. So this is interesting because both allocation of resources and cellular composition are measurable experimentally. Cellular composition in terms of proteome is easily measurable experimentally by mass spectrometry. You can do proteomics and get the amount of every protein and then divide them by sectors and get this pie chart. And you can also think about measuring allocation, which is a bit trickier. You would have to, there are techniques that basically tell you where which transcripts are being transcribed by ribosomes. So in principle, you can test this. And the third aspect is homeostasis. And here we're going to talk about homeostasis of, proteome fraction of cellular composition. So the fraction of, for example, this phi r is the fraction of your proteome, which is ribosome. Of course, these fractions are going to be in trade-off. So if you make more enzymes, you're going to increase this flux, but you're also going to decrease the ribosomes that you're making. So you need to optimize, if you want, a trade-off between how much ribosomes you have, which guarantee you this this flux, the rate of biosynthesis, and how much amino acids are preparing for your ribosomes to make your proteins, which is this other flux. And assuming that this other part is constant, there will be something else that is constant. These two fractions of the pie will be in trade-off. So how do you get, this is a standard material, which by the way, most of it we just saw. So how do you get this homeostasis? It's very simple. You get it directly from the equations that we just saw. So from the first equation, we can write it. It's very from the first equation, you get a relationship that is always valid. I can divide by P. And this is lambda, and this is phi r, the fraction of proteome which is ribosome. And then I'm going to get a relationship which relates the fraction of proteome which is ribosomes with the growth rate. And they have to be in a linear relationship. So this is a testable statement. Okay. If I take the other equation, it's a bit... different, but it's quite, so sorry. But I can do the same, okay? Let's do it. So I can divide by P, and then I can apply chain rule. So I'm gonna get two terms, and here I'm gonna get the derivative of R over P. So from these two terms, I easily get this equation, which is nice because it tells me about the transient. It tells me it's kind of a logistic equation. I can put this is like sigma phi r times chi r minus phi r. So in order to get a steady state, this equation tells me that chi r has to be equal to phi r. So the allocation of ribosomes determines the steady state for the proteome fraction of ribosomes. And And then it tells me the kinetics. So if I do a nutrient shift, for example, if I change some of these parameters, I can use, this is an instantaneous equation, I can use this equation to describe the kinetics. Okay. But I have a missing ingredient, and this is actually what we will try to fill later on. How do I decide the allocation of my ribosomes? So the way Terry Waugh did it in this paper that was published now a few years ago, where they had a lot of data, they described these nutrient shifts, they put this phenomenological assumption that my allocation is just a function of my elongation rate. And they could do it because they went around with bacteria, with E. coli, and they measured for every nutrient condition, elongation rate, and ribosomal fraction, phi r. And they said, okay, chi r is equal to phi r at every steady state. I can show you the plot, because I don't have it. I have it somewhere, but... So they had sigma and phi r, which is chi r at steady state. And then it was, I don't know, something like this. And then they said, okay, I have this... points, I'm going to assume that this relation chi r of sigma is always the steady state relation, so my model is closed and I can make predictions. And they made predictions and they tested these predictions. Okay, so these predictions predict some laws. We said that the first law was that there has to be a linear relationship between ribosome fraction, which is like this axis, and growth rate, which should not depend on how you grow your bacteria. This is all Terry Waugh's data from E. coli from now 14 years ago. And it also says that the slope of this relationship should depend on the translation rate. So they did it with translation rate mutants, where they measured the translation rates, and they found that this was verified, which is striking, I think, if you are a biologist. I think if you are a physicist, if you hang out with the biologists for sufficiently long, I think this is almost a miracle. But anyway, it works very well. And then they said, okay, now we're going to put antibiotics, and we are going to decrease the translation. We are going to stall ribosomes with these antibiotics. And then we see what happens. And what happens is exactly what predicts what is predicted by this model, that you get an increased ribosomal fraction. Okay. It's kind of tricky, but this is not the same situation as changing the translation rate. In fact, if you measure... there's a whole hidden topic that I'm not going to enter, which is which fraction of your ribosomes are really active, are really actively translating. If you stall ribosomes with an antibiotic, you are decreasing the number of actively translating ribosomes, but you're, as they measured, you're actually increasing the translation rate of the ones that are translating, which is not what happens here. Here, all ribosomes are translating just with different translation rate because they have mutations in ribosomal proteins that affect the translation rate. But anyway, quantitative laws. The last quantitative law that I want to show you because it will be relevant for us. Now, I don't know. I have until 5:15, so we're back. And that clock is right. Let me see. Yeah, that is right. Okay, and is this one, still from the same paper by Terry Waugh, which is also quite interesting, because what they did is they had several ways to express proteins that are completely useless for E. coli. Everything was done in E. coli. And these are the different ways. And then they measured growth rate as a function of the fraction of unnecessary protein that they were expressing. And then they found that the growth rate is just a linear function of this fraction of unnecessary protein. So you could have actually very, in principle, very complex physiology in response to the expression of unnecessary proteins, but you don't. This very simple pie chart model that we just discussed is predictive. How is it predictive? Because unneeded proteins are going to be a sector, phi u, that's going to be in competition with the catabolic and ribosomal sector. So if you increase phi u, phi r has to go down, and phi r is lambda. So your growth rate has to go down accordingly. If ribosomes are the only limiting factor for growth, which is this expression, is expressed by this expression. So this is, okay, it may seem trivial, but think about, for example, one of the ways that E. coli is used, I think, the most, which is you have you use it to make stuff that you need. So you need whatever, an antibody, a protein. You put it in E. coli and you make it express it. And you want to have as much as possible of your protein from your bioreactor. So your first idea is that, okay, let's crank up the expression of my protein as much as possible. So I'm gonna get phi u as much as possible. But phi u is gonna affect my growth rate. If phi u is 30%, my growth rate is gonna be zero. So I'm gonna get zero of my protein. So I have to try to optimize. And my yield is something like the concentration of the protein that I get, phi u, times, let's say, the exponential factor, if I wait for a constant time and my bioreactor is giving me an exponential growth, which is something e to the lambda t, so it's e to the sigma times phi r t, the waiting time. So this is phi u times e to the sigma, you know, the maximum allocation that I can get from all the sectors that are not q, times the waiting time tw. So you see here that you get an optimum, which you can compute. And actually, if you think about it more carefully, there are some other factors that you have to take into account if you want to optimize. And biologists and biotechnologists, in this case, are very, very aware that there is an optimum. It's just that they try to get it empirically, or they just are happy when they get something. But these kind of frameworks, and you know, more complex than this, can give you like an a priori, a theoretical ground to get this optima. You can stall growth with the, it's actually what they measure, right?
No, I know it.
Because this plot, I didn't. It's actually a very good question. I didn't go through it. If you look at this plot, you can interpret it. So the cell is trying to increase its ribosomes when you stall them. So it's trying to compensate for the inhibitory, let's say, signal that you're giving it to growth. And it gets to some maximum fraction between 0.6 and 0.8. So this is interpreted as the maximum fraction that ribosomes can occupy. If you look at ribosomal proteins, so not the whole ribosomal sector in E. coli, this is like 25%, which means that at 25, let's say, if your useless protein is going to occupy this most of this 25%, then you cannot grow, because you also need everything else. So this phi q is the everything else that you need other than ribosomes. which is not 100%. Okay, so we are trying as a program to reproduce these growth laws beyond bacteria, because it might be surprising, but not many people did these measurements beyond bacteria. With yeast, people did. And we actually have one member of the lab who's a theorist with support of an experimental group in our institute is taking this data. So this is actually the same data that we just saw, but then for yeast. And it's, as you can see, it's more or less the same. I'm not going to say it's the same because it's very preliminary data. But for sure, you get an increase of RNA over protein, which is the classic proxy for a ribosomal sector. If you inhibit translation, and you get the same linear trend with nutrient quality. And we are also trying to do this through a collaboration in mammalian cells. And we do have some preliminary results that are promising. But I'm not going to talk about that today. And I'm also not going to talk about, because I thought you already saw it in the previous seminar, about what you get if you combine this framework with PLM. Because I think you're going to get it for free from Jean-Francois' course and Mathieu's seminar. But let's say the only message that probably you got already last week that I wanted to give you is that if you use this framework, so the way you saw it in the previous lecture, you can predict one of the important trends that you saw last week, which is that the volume growth rate is a linear, positive linear function of the dry mass density, macromolecular dry mass density, which means that you have homeostasis, because if your density is too large, you will dilute. If you're too dilute, you will slow down this growth rate. But this ends the introduction, and what I wanted to talk to you today is something simpler in the framework of these pure biosynthesis models, basically that work under the assumption that cell density is constant. And I'm going to show you, as I said, two things. And the first one is try to challenge this ribocentric view that I just showed you worked so well. And how do we challenge it? We start with a simple flux argument, which is the same, I think, almost, I don't know because I didn't read the Wang and Li paper, but it looks like it's almost the same as the one that Wang and Li proposed for transcription. But we propose it for translation. Again, we did everything with degradation, but for simplicity now we're going to assume that there is no degradation. And we're just going to look at one transcript and the ribosomes that are elongating. We are going to say that there is an influx initiation rate, if you want, that depends on the concentration of free ribosomes. So it's kind of a diffusion-limited initiation. And this is a rate per concentration. And then we're going to get ribosomes elongating. So there is a current that is speed times density. Speed is elongation rate per amino acid, and density is the number of bound ribosomes divided by the number of amino acids in a protein. But I clamped it into this parameter epsilon, which is related to the sigma that we had before, which is the elongation rate divided by the, so it's the protein production, basically. It's the inverse time it takes you to make a protein instead of one amino acid. So the density, speed time density is actually epsilon times the number of bound ribosomes. So at steady state, same assumption that we did before, I get a relationship for one transcript between the bound ribosomes and the free ribosomes with this ratio, alpha zero over epsilon, which is a proportionality constant. So if I want to multiply by the number of transcripts, I get the total translation current. So I use this. So the total translation current is the number of transcripts times this, which is the number of transcripts times this, thanks to this steady state relationship. And now I can use that the total ribosomes, which is the ones that I used here, are just the sum of the bound and unbound ribosomes. So if I use this, I go back to this equation, and I get m times alpha zero times rf. I substitute this, and I get an answer to a question that was formulated to Jean-Francois. It's a different answer. So somebody asked, I think he's not here anymore, but somebody asked, okay, why don't I get the number of transcripts in this equation? So you do get the number of transcripts. It just in this, if you do this assumption, it cancels out, but if you do this kinetic argument, it doesn't. So instead of this simple relationship, we propose that lambda is epsilon, which is sigma, is the same here, phi r, times the Michaelis-Menten-like function of the concentration of ribosomes, which has this threshold. This is, we say, the rate, and the rate divided by the concentration. So here, this is like a characteristic concentration of messengers above and below which you have different regimes. Okay, so this is what we proposed in this work, which is unpublished. And we do the model where we do this argument both for transcription and translation, and then we take a Terry-Wa kind of framework, which is the same that we saw previously with these assumptions, and we explore the consequences. So the first consequence is that the limitation phase diagram, which is the same that was discussed by Jean-Francois, becomes a bit different because you have these intermediate regimes of complex, which we call complex formation limiting, in lack of, let's say it's co-limitations. So where both concentration of messengers and ribosomal fraction play a role for into the expression for growth rate. So in between, let's say in the previous diagram, you had translation limiting and then you have saturation. So transcription is limiting. But if you explore these axis, which is the concentration of messengers, you can have this other regime. And then we went to the data, and we tried to argue with this data. I think we show that you need this model to understand some of the data. And for sure, the data don't work with this translation-limited model or the transcription-limited model, and let's say ours is a proposition how they could work. So one is that there is, I'm not citing it here, but I'm going to cite it in a second. There is another paper from Terry-Wa, which is another science paper that just got published, where they say, guys, there is also a growth law for messengers. If you look at the amount of messengers, concentration of messenger RNA, total concentration of messenger RNA per cell in E. coli, it's a linear function of growth rate. Okay? And this model doesn't explain it. And the other results that we wanted to try to understand are results from Nama Barkai's group in East, where they show that actually the cost of the expression of the unneeded protein is not just a function of the fraction of proteome occupied by this protein, but it changes if you change the copy number of the gene expressing this protein or the degradation rate of the messenger making this protein. They had this like two orthogonal perturbations. And they have plots like this, basically, where they can have basically at fixed, this is a proxy of the fraction of the proteome fluorescent. The protein is GFP, so it's green fluorescent protein, and they can measure it. So for the same level of green fluorescent protein, depending on the messenger degradation rate, they get very different growth rates. Okay, so this cannot be explained. This is just, let's say this would be the prediction for Let's go through these plots. This is the plot that we saw for E. coli, for Fi-R, which is, it's really the assumption of translation-limited growth. Transcription-limited growth, you wouldn't have this. You would have a constant. And vice versa, you would have this if you get transcription-limited growth. You wouldn't have it if you have translation-limited growth. Once again, this is the prediction for the cost of unneeded protein expression if translation is limiting. This wouldn't be reproducible if translation is limiting. So I don't think the details are really important. There are some details, but I don't think it's a good idea to enter these details now. So you just have to know that you can reproduce this data with this model, and then we can discuss the details. And you can also reproduce the results of Nama-Barkai under changing messenger stability using this model based on this kinetic argument. So this ends basically the first example that I wanted to give you. And now I turn to the second example, which is again something that we have out on BioArchive, which is about the other question. So these guys assumed here that allocation is a function of translation rate. And they said, okay, cool, I have a kinetic theory of growth rate changes in variable environments. And then they applied it to experiments where you shift the nutrients, you change the nutrients, and you look at growth rate, ribosome allocation, etc. But we think that, let's go through it, I think, if I can change. Before we go, so I'm going to tell you what we think before we go through it, because there are details. We think that it's a shortcut. So if you want, this is an adiabatic assumption. So you're assuming that the system behaves at steady state, even in transients. What it really does, it will have time scales for sensing nutrients, probably quick, but also time scales for expressing ribosomes according to the nutrients. Ribosomes are expressed by transcription and also by translation, because you have to transcribe ribosomal RNAs and ribosomal proteins, and then you have to translate ribosomal proteins. So it will take a while. Usually to transcribe and translate a protein, it takes you time that is of the order of one cell cycle to get to steady state. So there will be a response time. Okay. But then there are details, because if you want to describe the sensing and the allocation, you need to provide these details to your model. So if you ask Bianca, because that's actually how it happened, I asked Bianca, how do bacteria respond to nutrient changes? And Bianca is any other biologist, she told me, by PPGPP. So PPGPP in bacteria is the central regulation of ribosomal allocation. What is PPGPP? It's a small molecule that's made of GTP, so the guanine, the base that gets into DNA, 3-phosphates plus 1-extra-phosphate. And for some reason, it's used as a signal of how fast you have to grow, to the point that bacteria actually compete ecologically by telling other people, other bacteria, not to grow by PPGPP. They have toxins that are producers of PPGPP that, as I will tell you in a second, will decrease the ribosomal allocation of these other bacteria. So it's a sensor and it's a defector, PPGPP. Why is it a sensor? The standard theory is that it sits on ribosomes. There's a protein called RELAY that sits on ribosomes that is able to sense when uncharged tRNAs are basically bound on the ribosome and produces PPGPP from GTP. So if there's a lot of uncharged tRNAs, your PPGPP goes up which is the signal that tells the cell to slow down ribosome allocation, to decrease ribosome allocation. How? Because PPGPP can bind to through a protein to RNA polymerase, repressing the transcription of ribosomal RNAs. Okay. Why only ribosomal RNAs? Because there's a specific region, so it's specific sequence that you find only in ribosomal RNAs that's sensitive to this transcription and repression signal. So if I'm starving, I will have less charged tRNAs because I will have less amino acids charging my tRNAs, which will through relay increase my PPGPP levels, which will repress my ribosomal allocation. So a lot of steps, which is probably unlikely, that are just made by this kind of phenomenological steady state assumption that's the standard, more or less the standard. So we built these details into this model. Same framework that we saw before, actually the translation limiting framework for simplicity, where we added the sensor and then the actuator system. This is just the cartoon. And we said we had to provide an equation for amino acids, which we're going to see in a second, is exactly the same that we saw before on the board. And we had to provide an assumption for ribosome allocation. And we say that the fraction of ribosomes making ribosomes is just a fraction of transcripts that are ribosomes over transcripts that are all transcripts. Okay. So this is an assumption, and we don't know if this is the case. But it's a bit tricky because actually it's ribosomal RNAs that are regulated, and we're assuming that it's ribosomal proteins. But ribosomal proteins are also under the regulation of PPGPP through the same transcriptional system. These are the equations which are we had to add to the framework one equation for PPGPP production, which sets this fraction of RNA polymerases that are making ribosomes, okay, which is another allocation function which is different from the chi-R that we saw before. The chi-R for us is due to transcripts. So omega R is the fraction of RNA polymerases that are making ribosomes, which enters some, these are transcript production rate equations, exactly like the ones that Jean-Francois was writing. We're just saying that omega R is a function of G, is going to tell us the rate of transcription of ribosomal transcripts. Then we, if this goes to steady state with the time scale, or any time, let's say, the fraction of ribosomes that are making ribosomes, we assume, are the ratio of ribosomal transcripts to total transcripts. We also have to provide an equation for the steady state of amino acids, because then we have to provide an assumption for how elongation rate, tRNA charging, is related to PBGPP. So this enters this equation. What I want to try to, the details are not important, but what I want to convey is that amino acid levels are going to affect tRNA charging, which is going to affect PPGPP, which is going to affect RNA polymerase on ribosomes, which is going to affect ribosome allocation, which is in turn affecting translation, which is affecting amino acid fluxes. So there is a full feedback loop, which was not present in the other theories. So if we go to steady state, I will cut a long story short, but I have time, we can fit standard data. And again, our theory is good for fast growth, because at slow growth, there are things that happen that I didn't tell you about. a slow growth. I told you that something is happening, which is that degradation becomes relevant. But there's something else is happening that is not really well characterized even in E. coli, which is that ribosomes somehow get inactive. So, and this is why there is an offset in this law. This prediction is that there is no offset. This offset tells me that at zero growth, there are a fraction of ribosomes, but those ribosomes are inactive. Now, some of these ribosomes are actually compensating the turnover due to degradation. And initially I thought these were all the ribosomes. I mean, there are ribosomes because there is degradation and there is turnover, so there's maintenance ribosomes that are actually doing turnover. But if you try to explain it, you only get explain one third of this offset. So what Terry Wah says is that there are proteins, and again, this must be specific of E. coli, but the offset somehow is not specific of E. coli. There are proteins that sequester ribosomes and make them inactive at slow growth. And why? What's the interpretation? Because if you're growing slowly, you might be growing faster later on in your life, so you have to be ready. But all this is like kind of a shady area that is not really, totally understood. So we're going to stay in fast growth, where our data, let's say, our theory fits very well the data at fast growth, where you don't have all this mess. We also fit, let's say, reproduce steady state data that are more, that are more mechanistic, if you want, like the relationship between PPGPP levels and growth rate, and PPGPP levels and phi R. Okay. And now we are also looking into perturbations where you increase relay expression with some other collaborators. And now you have some nutrient flux, some nutrient quality, but you force the cells to have the wrong signal for ribosomal location. And then we're looking whether this model can predict the steady state and also the shift. But as usual in biology, it's more complicated than you would think. And then we also have predictions for things that people didn't really measure as across growth rates. For example, the amino acid pool. But the problem is that you don't have one amino acid like in our theory. You have 21 amino acids, and probably, so we would have to generalize the theory to more than one amino acid and try to understand the limitation regimes of the amino acid levels in order to actually test this theory. And it's a mess because you have requirements of amino acids that are different for every amino acid because they depend on the proteome composition, which changes with the growth rate. And then you have amino acids that are not used. I think at some point Jean-François is going to touch this issue. You have amino acids that are not used to make proteins. Romain makes a big deal about this, and he's right, I think, because glutamine and glutamate is used for many, like to make other amino acids, for example. But if you look also at the intracellular concentrations of these amino acids, they cannot be explained just by protein making. But then we did the theory to describe out of equilibrium situations, and that's why we wanted to build this whole feedback, because we noticed that it was not done by theories that were available in the literature. And because you have this mixed feedback loop, you get oscillatory response everywhere. You actually even get a Hopf bifurcation if you go unphysical growth rates that are unachievable, but it's fun to know. And this is very general, and it's due to this basically architecture that I just discussed, we think is built into this system. So we think this system must do oscillation because it has to, unless it has ways that we don't really understand or have characterized yet to avoid these oscillations. So it's a sensor, and there is an actuator with a time delay, so if you feed it back, it has to give you oscillations. And then we went to data, and these are data that were actually produced within our collaboration in fancy microfluidic devices, where we think, which are actually our original motivation. We started to do this theory because we wanted to understand this data. But we don't have a lot of this data, so we need to produce more of this data. We also went to TerryWatt's data, and we think that they fit something that does not oscillate on some data that might actually have at least an overshoot. And these are all data from the 80s. Maybe we shouldn't even show them or trust them, but or maybe they're good. It's just there aren't a lot of data about this, but we're pretty sure that if you do the theory seriously, that's what you get. And this is my, let's say, the end of my story. I have 4 minutes. So basically, what I wanted to try to convince you is that despite of the like dominant specificity in biology, and in particular in the biology of cell growth, there are general principles like flux balance, mass conservation, autocatalysis, that allow us to build these frameworks. Then, of course, if you have an experiment, you have to understand what's going on. There's going to be a lot of things that are specific, that are relevant, that you have to understand. But this doesn't mean that there is a general setting, that there isn't, sorry. Then we have these two specific stories where I think that this kind of co-limitation regime is what a consistent argument on the messenger flux would give you. We actually generalized it now, allowing for traffic on the messengers and on the genes with these 1D traffic models from statistical physics. And you get a phase diagram that is even richer. And then we have this theory that tries to put all the steps together about sensing and allocation, and what we get is that you must have oscillations. And then I already told you that these things are relevant. People are going in, now this field almost has like between 50 and 20 years without the physics. Let's say, I would say this field was there for a long time, and now one of the directions that it's going is try to figure out also the soft matter and electrolyte physics parts, and the others are ecology and cell cycle progression. You're going to get some of that. So I'm done, I think, almost on time. These are the people that basically worked on our project, are Ludovico from the first project. And I don't know what I'm doing. Maybe I should do it here. Ludovico for the first project, who just left our lab, and Rossana is another PhD student who's still working on this. And then I want to mention some collaborators. I already mentioned Mathieu, these things, I didn't show you a lot of data. I didn't do data first, as sometimes I like to do. But we do interact on data with Bianca and with Pietro in Cambridge, and more recently with Greg and Milan in Delft on these PPGPP perturbations. Okay, thank you.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.